Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm delighted to see here with us today is Hannah Fields, Head of Marketing and Membership for the Open Data Institute. Hi, Hannah. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
There will be a few of our listeners who will not have heard of the Open Data Institute. Probably not many, but a few. So it'd be quite helpful if you just said, you know, what you guys do, what does the ODI do? Apart from just being round the corner from the computer.
Yeah, apart from just being very practical.
How was your journey here today?
So the ODI works with companies and governments around the world to build an open and trustworthy data ecosystem. So in short, we want a world where data benefits everyone. And on a practical level, it means that we do training, policy work, research and development. We have quite a broad membership network. And so we even though we have quite a big mission, all the stuff we do has to be practical. And it's about upskilling people and giving them the tools and resources to be able to achieve these things themselves.
Yeah.
And we were founded by, co-founded by the inventor of web, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, and AI expert Sir Nigel Shadbolt in 2012. And as you said, we're just around the corner.
Yeah. And every week, you and your team, you do a week in data newsletter, finding some quirky stories from the world of data, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. So we've been doing it for a few years now.
Uh-huh.
And we pick what we think is the most interesting stuff happening out there that week, which isn't heavily technical, it's not overly deep. It's basically stuff that people should know about or could be fun and interesting. And we pick those things out so that this news becomes accessible to everyone. People often think that data news isn't for them, so we're trying to make it more sort of broadly available to people. And so we've got quite a vastly growing readership, which is really nice. And so, yeah, we pick five stories from the world every week. We usually have an angle on it, we try and make it funny, and then we talk a bit about what we're focusing on, but really the focus is on what's happening in the outside world.
Sounds like you really enjoy it, actually.
Yeah.
You can see that in what you're saying. So Hannah's going to share a few of those stories from this week's edition in a wee bit. Otherwise in the podcast, Claire, you're going to be talking about
the Women in Software Power List. So I teased at the end of the last
you
podcast
did.
That
yes.
I'd be out and about, but that I couldn't tell you where I was. And it's because the nominations for the list launched on Wednesday, and that's where I was. So I couldn't tell you about it until the nominations opened, and that's what I'm going to fill you in on today.
Cool. And Caroline, you've also been out and about.
Yes. Caroline Donnelly went to Parliament this week, which has a nice ring to it, I think. And yes, so I was there to sit in on the inaugural meeting of the newly formed Lone Charge all-party parliamentary group. So yeah, I'll update you on what went down there.
And I'm going to talk very briefly about the report from the Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation, the CDEI, their report about online targeting, which was published this week. One of the many organisations in London that have the word data in their title. So we're going to start with Hannah. You know, you're in the spotlight now. So there's a few stories that piqued your interest this week. Well, first one was about a Berlin artist with a bunch of mobile phones. What was he up to?
So we've called this week's newsletter "What Kind of Trickery Is This?" And it's kind of piqued our interest because we hear a lot about AI tricking humans.
Yes.
We don't always hear about humans tricking AI. So there's been a few things in the news that sort of demonstrated almost a human uprising, which is quite humorous as well. Through a lot of our own work, we've sort of noticed that people know a lot more about how data about them is used than we give them credit for. So we did a report recently with the RSA Illuminate where we interviewed some people. And so these stories kind of play into that about sort of this human response. And so there's an artist who, in Berlin, has been tricking Google Maps into thinking there's a traffic jam in a particular place by pulling 99 smartphones around with him in a tiny little red hand car. It's all very sweet. It seems really lo-fi way of tricking such a sort of huge organisation. But what is quite interesting about it is that he's kind of exploring how Google Maps as kind of a new form of mapping from the sort of traditional two-dimensional maps is having an impact on society, like organisations like Uber, Airbnb are rising up through this kind of new geospatial data, this kind of real-time data. Mm. And so he's sort of playing with that as an artist. So we thought that was quite fun and gave a nice new angle on how to talk about that.
Yeah, it does sound very Berlin artist.
It does.
Crazy conceptual thing they would do.
Could you potentially... So was he drawing a picture in Google traffic? Because you know when you log onto Google Maps and if there's a higher level of traffic, it's in a different colour. It'll be like red or orange. So was he drawing a picture in the map?
So they were forcing sort of the red colour of traffic jams to emerge on the map.
Mm.
So I don't know that there was a particular pattern. Yeah. I don't think that was the final piece. It was more of kind of a commentary on the whole exercise of... fooling Google Maps.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it became an artwork in itself after, but I think that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah.
I quite like that. And I love the fact that people do play around with and get quite playful with things like Map My Run and where you can just see sort of shapes. I tried that once and it failed miserably.
Yeah, people in Strava, don't they? Well, people draw some very not safe for work pictures by running particular routes that... Yes.
So they really have to know this.
Because they write about it on things like BuzzFeed.
Yeah. Keeps motivated to keep going. Like,
I suppose so. Mm. But this conceptual Berlin artist isn't the only one trying to fool the AIs. Some kids doing this as well.
Yeah, that's right. So again, sort of playing into the fact that we think people are, or society seems to think that people are oblivious to what's happening with the ad targeting. This group of teenagers are sort of rebelling in Maryland in America by grouping together and sharing each other's account details so that when they get targeted with adverts, they just end up being quite random because they're not targeting one specific person, they're targeting a group of individuals. So not only have they understood how the whole targeting thing works, they've worked out how to kind of game the system.
Yeah, I read that one, and at first I found it so confusing that I didn't even understand what the end goal was. So how they've come up with this idea, you know, like that if they give multiple people access to their Instagram account across, you know, basically worldwide. I think they started off in America, some people, you know, like are logging into them from different countries, that there are certain things that Instagram can't figure out about you, like where you're going to be or like where you live, where you work, what you're doing. I thought that was really cool. It took me a while to understand that that's what their end goal was, though. I was a bit like, but they still know things about you because you've signed up, so you've given them some data.
Yeah. I think it's sort of the behavioural targeting, though, is still something that people very much care about, even if, you know, we're doing a lot of work around sort of protected characteristics that also feeds into the sort of, the CDEI report you're going to be talking about later.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like your age and your gender, people do care about that. But there's a whole scope of things that people might care about, and the way that you behave is very, very personal, and the things that you're interested in change, and they're still quite personal. So I think that in itself, it might be a good incentive to, again, try and game the system by seeing if you can kind of fool people into thinking that you're interested in things you're not. Because these things are quite personal, you know. They, and it would be just interesting to find out more about the kind of levels of where people feel like they're sort of data about them is being shared a bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested to know where that line is drawn for people.
Yeah, I'd like to see a pattern of data that led to a particular ad. When ads are so personally targeted that you think there can't possibly be any way that they've pinpointed that unless they were listening to actual conversations. You know, that That's when I want to know, like, how they've deduced that, mm-hmm. if they really are just listening all the time.
Yeah. I mean, equally, I think ads sometimes can seem a bit basic.
Yeah.
You get targeted for something that's completely wrong, mm-hmm. and you kind of know how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
Something you search for, but it's not quite right.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I'm interested in and the ODI is interested in particular in engaging people in that conversation more and more, and making that conversation accessible to people.
Yeah.
So it's not just a conversation that regulators have, or that the government has, or kind of chief data officers have with each other. It's conversations that real people have. And I think that's why stories like these show that people who aren't techie can still sort of interact with that dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, those two stories kind of raging against the machine in a way.
yeah.
Quite fun. But another one of the stories that you picked out this week is about kind of one of the biggest and most serious stories of the day, the coronavirus.
Mm.
Mm. Tell us about that.
Yes. So,
More sharing of scientific information, basically.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, there is a good news story, it seems, to come out of all the news around the coronavirus, which is, you know, traditionally researchers, they have been blamed for being quite private about their data and their findings in order to be able to reach the headlines or for some sort of competitive advantage.
Yeah, kind of store it off for a brilliant journal paper that establishes your career and stuff.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So, but it seems that sort of global health scientists are saying at the moment that the tide is changing and that more data is being shared so that systems can now respond better to the virus. So basically there's an unprecedented level of openness and collaboration, which is amazing. And so things like where the disease might spread to next, where they might want to implement travel restrictions or allocate healthcare provisions, things like that, are kind of developing more quickly because scientists are being more open to sharing data. And you need mountains of data to be able to do this stuff. So the more, it goes without saying, the more data and the more data sharing, the more sort of intelligent these systems can be.
Mm.
Mm.
No, because that is really interesting, because something I've covered on my beat within cloud quite a lot in the last couple of years is the fact that cloud is being held as this way to allow sort of researchers in different countries from a scientific point of view to share findings and stuff like that. But it's always in the context of maybe kind of to progress knowledge of diseases that have not in real time, as in the coronavirus could potentially be an epidemic across the UK, across the world, whereas previously it's just been, it could further our knowledge about diseases out there like Parkinson's that have a long lead time and stuff like that. So the fact it's being used to build these patterns of spread and kind of, where it's going to go next in real time, I think it's really, really exciting.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, so it's a worrying thing, isn't it, the old coronavirus? I'm worried about my travel now.
Don't go.
You don't get to go.
Stay at home.
I know.
Well, I was going to say LG pulled out of MWC this week because they said they were concerned about it, because they're concerned about bringing people over from their own teams from the region over here and potentially spreading it, but also if anyone on the ground over there has got it, because it's a global gathering of people all centred on one area in Barcelona, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mobile World Congress.
Globalisation, yeah.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting, actually, the other conferences over the next few months, see if that's affected by it. Will we see like a contingent of journalists from different regions not going, or teams, or countries and stuff, companies?
Mm.
What really?
Can't afford to be out. Might just stay in a room.
Or just walk around just with all the masks on, the gloves, everything. I think also, with MWC though, one of the big selling points is that people launch devices, everyone's got their hands on it and everything, so you just kind of think, hands on devices, unless you're squirting it with anti-vac between each one, I think it's right to be concerned, yeah.
Well, you're ready, aren't you, for some kind of apocalypse?
Oh, yeah, always.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not going to help you, Brian.
Yeah.
I don't know, you could help me out, give me some advice, some steers, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's every person for himself in an apocalypse.
First sign of any kind of illness, I'm spraying you with antibac and running away.
Well, I suppose there's lots of things about the coronavirus we don't really know yet. Mystery.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the last podcast, we had a bit of a mystery, because you said, you teased us, as you said at the top of the podcast.
Yeah, I teased you. I couldn't tell you where I was going, but now I can. So on Wednesday, I was at Makers, who are a software engineering bootcamp.
Okay.
They launched their second annual Women in Software Power List. I'm one of the judges. I was one of the judges last year. I went to go and just sort of listen to what everyone had to say about why it's important to have lists of women. And I've spoken about that before because we have our own
top 50. We have our own list. Yeah,
top 50 women in UK tech as well. So it's important to have lists like this.
It's software specifically.
Yes, this is specifically women in software. There's open applications. There's a list of the criteria that people are looking for in the judging process on the website where you can apply.
Yeah.
I think I need to double check this, but I think 30 women are picked for the power list, and this year there's going to be a winner of the power list as well.
Oh, right.
They also launched this year a change makers list. So makers are quite aware and vocal about the fact that, you know, there isn't equality in tech yet, but that there are initiatives out there that are doing stuff to try and shift the dial and change that. So the change makers list is aimed at teams who have done something in the last 3 years or so to sort of progress diversity in the tech sector.
Cool.
So yeah, that's pretty cool as well.
And I wonder if there'll be, women from the software industry or women who've been involved in promoting better use of software, like government policy, those kind of people, or is it very much an industry thing?
Last year it was very much people in engineering type roles.
Yeah, cool. And our list, we've got a real spread, haven't we? We've got like venture capitalists and CEOs of non-profits and things like that.
Yeah, quite a lot of people on our top 50 women in UK tech are very, you know, like it's quite broad. It can be, you know, people like you said, CIOs, venture capitalists, startups, and you know, just general people working to make the industry better, things like that.
And women who have strong input into government, whether civil servants or maybe MPs, and on the list. In the past, I know we've had Jenny Tennyson from the Open Data Institute, and so on. Getting more women into Parliament, I suppose, would be a good thing.
Getting more women everywhere would be a good thing.
Well, our very own Caroline went to Parliament this week.
I do like going to Parliament. It's very exciting.
It is exciting.
And
we don't often get the chance.
No.
Yeah.
We were discussing this earlier, weren't we?
Yeah.
Being like, sort of, if you were covering, say, Liz's beat, who does the public sector.
She does that.
Parliament, trips to Parliament, they're like, I'm going.
She's
there.
Sick again.
Yeah. Whereas for us, it's a bit more, bit few and far between. So it's still, well, I find it very exciting. It sort of feels a bit like when you go through security, first of all, so airport security, then you go into the big hall, and there's loads of people milling around, and you sort of suddenly feel like you're a bit on a school trip. and because my trip there was quite late in the day, I actually took my own sandwiches with me in case I got peckish. So I was like, hey, it's like a school trip.
You're so well organised.
I know. But the reason I was there was to witness and report on the inaugural meeting of the newly formed Lone Charge All-Party Parliamentary Group, which is a lot of letters. And they're leading the inquiry into the loan charge scandal, which we've talked about quite a lot on the podcast in the past. And I have tried really hard, and I've managed to sum it up in one paragraph.
Okay.
Fantastic.
So, in simple terms, there are tens of thousands of people around the UK, a large proportion of which are IT contractors, who HMRC is demanding six-figure tax bills from, relating to work they did, at the moment, up to a decade ago. Because they opted to be remunerated for that work in the form of a non-taxable loan instead of a conventional salary. And there's a lot more to it than that, but I've written loads about it, so go and read that. So that's it. But that is the summing up of it. So there's the people, huge tax bills, it's a retrospective tax going back 20 years, And because the sums of money are just so huge, how do you have any means of paying that off, basically? So this meeting was being chaired by a group of MPs from all parties, and they wanted to hear directly from the people, the contractors who are affected by this. They wanted to know kind of what is the impact it's having on you personally as a, you know, living under this sort of strain of a massive tax bill, the impact it's having on their families, their lives and stuff like that. And also just they wanted to get, there was quite a lot of quizzing going on from the MPs about their treatment at the hands of HMRC. Like how do one of the MPs there, Ruth Cadbury, who's a Labour MP, she was sort of keen to zero in on sort of, you know, would you describe HMRC's behaviour as unreasonable in any of this and how they've dealt with you? And suddenly all these sort of accounts started coming out from the people present. There were five contractors there present. Four out of the five didn't want their identities to be known, so using pseudonyms and stuff like that. Because I think there is, you know, some of them are still trying to get work, and also some of them haven't, I don't know in that case, but a lot of the contractors we've spoken to in recent weeks on this don't tell their families that they're under this kind of financial pressure, because they don't want them to know. So it's a lot of shame and kind of things like that. So a lot of them didn't want to be, didn't want their identities to be known. So the meeting went on till about 7 p.m, but there was a few disruptions in between because apparently Tuesday, which is the day it happened, is the busiest time in the Houses of Parliament, and there was an NHS funding bill going on. So you'd hear, like, someone would answer a question and then a bell would ring and all the MPs would just file out.
I'm like, I'll go. Okay.
So you'd sit there and have a break. I wasn't, one of the restrictions, there was quite strict reporting restrictions on the event for the press, that we weren't allowed to talk to any of the contractors beforehand or after or during. So you could
just at all.
Yeah, so we could ask questions to the group, but we weren't allowed to directly approach any of them.
Right.
So all the MPs would leave and you'd just sit there sort of like, courting these people who are all sat in a line here, which was a bit surreal.
Were there any other journalists?
Yeah, there were. There was people from BuzzFeed there and one of the other B2B publications, Contractor UK, and also the Financial Times as well.
Okay.
So, so some of the things that were being talked about, there were some quite difficult to listen to accounts from the people involved, but there was one lady in particular who was quite interesting. Her name was Catherine, and she actually reached a settlement for her, with HMRC, so she paid off her tax bill, and it was £400,000.
What?
And she had to sell her home to fund it. And she said the trade-off was either I sell my home or it's my health that will suffer because of the stress of all this. And she got told that if you settle now for £400,000, it's a lot of money.
Gonna leave it.
But if you don't, it will go up to £500,000. So it's either, you know, pay now or pay more. So she did, she settled. And then a little while after got a follow-up request for payment of another £80,000.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And she sort of said she hasn't been able to work for the last 18 months just because of sort of emotional, mental burnout from dealing with this. But she was saying that some of the tactics, when this question about, you know, how is HMRC their dealings with you, what's that been like? And some of the stuff she was saying, which everyone in the line of contractors was nodding along with and sharing their own sort of thoughts, like sort of similar stories as well. And she was saying that one of the things that seems to happen is that every time there is a request for payment or there is something that comes from HMRC, some kind of written communication, it always seems to be timed to arrive at some point. You can't do anything about it for a little while. So the letters always seem to arrive on a Friday, so you spend the whole weekend stewing on it.
Yeah, just a weekend gone, yeah.
Yeah, or you, and she's, you know, at that point, they arrive on a Friday morning, you come in from work Friday evening, you can't do anything. A lot of them arrive sort of before bank holiday, so you spend the whole time during the bank holiday stewing on it. And she thinks, and a few other people on the panel
it's
made
a
this point as well.
Strategy.
Yeah,
right.
To sort of make you kind of stress so much that you might make a rash decision, or you might think, oh, you know what, I'm just going to pay it. Something's got to be better than dealing with this stress for the extended period. So, like I said, a lot of other people on the panel were kind of nodding in agreement and were sharing their own thoughts on this. And something else as well, she sort of said that a lot of the communications that do come from them are incorrect, so you're being sort of sent letters demanding payments, or she said that she got sent a letter from a debt recovery team saying, oh, we need to recover a debt from you. She didn't have a debt, she has a tax bill, but she doesn't have a debt. When you're saying debt recovery, you're talking bailiffs and things like that who could potentially come knocking on your door. And so she was like, she was sort of sitting there, I've got this letter, I can't do anything about it for a few days. And then she contacted HMRC and, oh, that was sent an error. But so it's causing unnecessary stress because it's just, so she was sort of suggesting, are they making deliberate mistakes to sort of pile the pressure on more to make you act a certain way? And this was, like I say, there was other people sort of nodding their heads. There was a guy who said he got sent a letter that arrived on the 20th of December, so a few days before Christmas, saying he would be declared bankrupt if he didn't make a payment or take some action by the 18th of December. But the letter arrived on the 20th, and even if it had arrived on the 18th, I don't know if you ever tried calling HMRC's call centre, but you were on hold for hours anyway. So there was all these kind of accounts, and I think the general consensus were that, yeah, they're not, you know, it's who can say if it's deliberate or not, but they're not doing anything to sort of relieve the pressure that people are under from this. Well, HMRC, because this is actually something that happened this week, I obviously, in response to this, being a very responsible reporter, I went to HMRC for a response to say, look, this is what MPs have been told in this open forum. Would you like to make any like response to it? And the thing about dates, which is the only thing they responded to, they didn't respond to a thing about the deliberate mistakes. But they said, oh, you know, it's an absolutely bizarre claim to make that we would specifically choose dates that we know will cause maximum kind of distress and harm. But then since the story has come out, I've had people on Twitter, people emailing me saying, oh, I haven't had a birthday, but I haven't had a letter from HMRC on since the loan charge has been going on. People saying, oh, Christmas, I just know, I basically count down the days to Christmas, but also count down to the days that a brown envelope with bad news is going to arrive from HMRC. It's quite interesting now, I think, that kind of aspect of it is coming under the microscope, that MPs are lasering in on it. Obviously, we're reporting on it. HMRC is saying it doesn't happen, you know, we don't know what you're talking about. But we have had that before. Like, when I've been doing some of the IR35 stories previously, I've had press... Claire's been in the office when it's happened, where I've had a press officer phone up and just shout at me, telling me that, like, when I've gone to them for comment on stories saying, oh, we've been told that X number of contractors are walking off public sector IT projects because of IR35. And yeah, they'll just be like, that's not happening. No one's leaving the public sector. No one's leaving jobs over this. And you're like, but I've got people telling me that they're not going into work on Monday because they're quitting. And it's like, that's not happening. That's just no contractors leaving. And you're like, okay, fine. So there has always been this bit of, so, you know, they'll tell you that's not happening and then you have evidence to the contrary. And I wrote a big blog post previously, having a bit of a go at HMRC over that, which we'll share the link to in the summary. But yeah, there is more a growing focus on their behaviour. What are they doing? When you've got a government policy that's been linked to sort of at least 7 suicides at this point, it's like, you know, their behaviour, I think, does have to come under the microscope a bit more. So I think we'll see more either stories come out from contractors, because they are sort of banding together now. We've got the Loan Charge Action Group, where they are, that's an open forum, very supportive people. You know, in the past, you can imagine, and they're getting these letters. Who do you tell you're getting a letter like this and stuff like that? So I think we will hear more about it, and we'll be digging into it a bit more as well.
And I know your coverage is quite, it's very well regarded and it's very appreciated by some of the people who have been affected by this.
It's quite, like I say, it's kind of like, well, that's nice, but like, you hope, like I say, some of the stories you hear, it makes a difference,
but
who knows.
Yeah.
As they said at that meeting the other day, there are things afoot to help overturn the loan charges, a judicial review and stuff like this, but as one of the MPs made the point, everything, particularly where government is concerned, moves at such a glacial pace that it's just like, is it happening quick enough for some of the people involved?
And would it benefit anybody who might have already paid, like the lady that you mentioned? She's already paid 400,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So would it benefit her would she get any kind of like money back for that?
That's one of the things. There is something in the review that came out a little while ago on that point, that some people would get money back if they settled early. But for some reason, she doesn't qualify, and I didn't quite follow why, because the review is 83 pages long, and I think not a tax expert. But yeah. But some people, that's one of the biggest criticisms of the review, that the government have said, 30,000 people, I think it was, will benefit from the outcome of the review.
Mm.
But then there's still so many people that won't, or they might benefit for the time being, but that 30,000, but then other things are afoot that means they'll come back into the scope of the policy later on.
Yeah.
Well, as well as doing a brilliant and amazing job on these topics, I'm sure you don't really want to be told that, but you are.
Oh, thank you.
You're also a resident expert on a little bit of relief, maybe, from the kind of human drama at All Matters
drama.
Cloud.
Yes.
I know you wanted to say a few things about Google Cloud Platform.
Yeah, I just thought it was really interesting. I'm trying to think, it was like back end of last year, there was this story that Google was not getting the traction it wanted to in the public cloud. It grown frustrated that it was still just the number three biggest player in a huge market, just not good enough for it. So there'd been this talk, that there'd been discussions apparently in early 2018 that maybe they should just, as Google has a habit of doing, should it just shut down its service and just exit the public cloud like HPE have before it, as Dell have before it, just leave and, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, it's yours now, I'm out of here, and leave.
We were talking about leaving a party last week with Claire about exiting the market and stuff.
Yeah, so they sort of, so apparently they had grown disenchanted. This is what, there was a report, let's say, at the end of last year about this. And then Google, again, being a responsible journalist, I went to them for comment on it. And they said that the reporting of it wasn't accurate. But they didn't say the actual, you know, news that they might have been considering it was inaccurate. Mm-hmm. They just said the way it had been reported, perhaps those discussions about their decision to leave had been maybe not reported accurately. So, but no, it seems, you know, a year is a long time in cloud, and now they're having a great time. So so they had this thing this week, which is quite significant.
They're still at the party.
Yeah, so there was this thing that happened this week, which is, I think a sign of how happy your company is with how it's performing is how transparent their financial reporting is. Oracle. So so they have become...
For shame.
So they've become a bit more transparent with reporting how much money Google Cloud makes, which is quite... Their financial results came out this week, and for the first time ever, they've separated out figures on Google Cloud. Previously, it was just, if you want to know how well Cloud's doing, we report that in other revenue, which is also like in other revenue is the money that it makes from Google Play, the app marketplace, and hardware. So it's like, oh, okay, so if you'd say, oh, other hardware, that's gone up, revenue's gone up 10%, you can say with any degree of confidence, oh, that's all down to cloud.
Yeah.
So they've separated that out now, and they have announced that Google Cloud on its own, it's on course to generate $10 billion of revenue a year. So it's a $10 billion revenue rate business.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which, put that into context, AWS took about 10 years to get to that point. They got that to that point in 2016.
Okay.
So it's quite a nice trajectory to be on.
Yeah.
But they're still number three in the market, so I don't know if they'll just turn around and like, still not good enough, and then leave it another day. But no, they were saying in their results something that's been quite pivotal in all that is they've done a few different things. Some of this started under the oversight of their previous CEO Diane Greene.
Mm-hmm.
So they started zeroing in on how to make Google Cloud be seen as like a bit more enterprise ready. So they started rolling out sort of sector specific services and offerings like that. And then she left, and Thomas Kurian, the ex Oracle guy, took over, I think, beginning of last year. And since then, those efforts sort of ramped up. There's been a lot more, actually, quite interestingly, along with Thomas Kurian, a lot more other senior leaders within Google have been appointed who are all from a sort of enterprise IT background.
Yes.
And they've all been bought in as well. So, and on the back of that, they were saying, I think the number of deals they're getting now in enterprises that exceed, it might be 50 million, but I might be wrong, has gone up. But yeah, the value of the deals they're seeing, deal sizes are going up, number of actual enterprises using their technology is going up as well now. So it's kind of quite a nice sort of success story, but also it just makes reporting on all this stuff a bit more interesting if you've got more companies to report on doing stuff and just saying AWS is doing this, Microsoft doing that, you know, to have a kind of a challenger sort of rising up the ranks makes everything a bit more interesting. So.
And I wonder if that might give them a bit of an engine to start acquiring some applications businesses.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, they're quite in quite an interesting position if you do pit them against Amazon and Microsoft particularly. Amazon is built around an infrastructure services business. They don't really have a massive software as a service play. Obviously, Microsoft does with Office 365 and Dynamics and things like that.
And then Google has got G Suite, which is a big consumer product, but also a huge sort of enterprise player as well. Whereas AWS doesn't have that. Like, it does have, it has a, quite a, I'm going to say minor sort of productivity play, but nothing to rival that. So yes, so it'd be interesting, I think, you know, given their growth, revenue growth is going up so much. I think there's some analyst figures out this week saying Google Cloud, market share wise, is creeping up a few percentage points each year, whereas Amazon seems to have bottomed out now about 33%. So if you, you know, climbing the ranks, so who knows?
Well, they may get to a point where Larry Ellison at Oracle might start denouncing Google.
Maybe, could do. Stranger
as well as AWS.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that the goal?
Yes, he just wants to shout out people.
Well, Google is one of those platforms that were mentioned this week in the Center for Data Ethics and Innovation report on online targeting.
Mm-hmm.
So they were talking about, they've been talking about online targeting in a kind of fairly broad sense of, you know, Netflix recommending the next thing you might want to see or whatever. Which and we as consumers we benefit to some extent from that, but it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because we also can be like effectively victimized by that level of targeting. One of the things that they said in the report that they published this week was none of the kind of regulators who are in play at the moment really have any power to do much about Google, Facebook, etc. In the report, they just talk about online platforms. They don't really mention the platforms themselves.
Mm.
We all know exactly who they are.
Mm.
But they've recommended a bit more regulation, and they talked about that being done by the Online Harms Regulator, which I think is the UK Council for Internet Safety. You know, the thing that was set up last year.
Mm-hmm.
They also talk about the Competition and Markets Authority and the Information Commissioner's Office as playing a potentially more of a regulatory role as well. The report was based on some research.
Of course.
which seems pretty legit this time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
which was done by Ipsos Mori, and the University of York was involved in this research as well. So just one figure from it, 29% trust the platforms, they will stop.
29% of users.
Users who were surveyed trust like Google, Amazon, Facebook, etc. Maybe that's quite a high number, 29%.
Yeah, I think so. That seems high to me.
Yeah, it's about a third. Two thirds don't.
Yeah, I guess it depends what they trust them about. What does that mean?
To look after their information and, you know, be respectful of their information and act in an ethical way. Because this is all about doing online targeting, but doing it in a way that is ethical and that respects people's privacy and stuff like that.
But there's no point doing it if they're not going to make money out of it.
Well, there's the question, isn't it? Because the first duty of a company is to make profits for its shareholders.
Mm.
So, yeah, no, it's not easy. And Roger Taylor, the chair of the centre, in his forward to his report, says, you know, it's not going to be easy to do this. And if, I mean, it isn't going to be easy, is it? Because these are very, very powerful companies.
We when we read about this week at the ODI, we were really pleased to see it. In particular around things like, we call it sort of opportunities data, and they called it that in the report. So things like when you're targeting somebody by their age for a job, or for credit, or for housing, these really important life decisions, and you're being sort of targeted for these things based around these protected characteristics.
Yeah.
And so these things really have a strong impact on an individual.
Mm.
And so that's particularly for that area being focused on for the report, we felt was really important. And particularly because we agree that people do care about how data about them is used.
Yeah.
This report really highlights that.
Yeah.
I think what we're interested in seeing next is how the government itself is going to help equip regulators, as you were saying earlier, with the right skills to be able to regulate such a changing environment and an ever-developing environment with lots of money behind it? How do you equip regulators to keep up with that? But also how they also sort of show and develop their own ethical practice in government for things like public services and how they target and personalise those.
Yeah.
As you said, they're really important to people. It's important that people know, you know, if everybody, as this report says, if everybody had a wealth of information about everything, you wouldn't know what was useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
You'd just be overwhelmed. You need targeting these services to know what you can use and what's useful. But we need to know in an ethical, we need to know that that's being used in an ethical way, and we need to know how those decisions are made about what I find out about and what I don't find out about.
Yeah.
And so that's why we're really pleased to see this report and kind of agree with a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and one of the kind of big recommendations from the report was to increase researcher access. The regulator, however, whatever form that takes, should be able to demand of Facebook, etc., that they open up their data to researcher access.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important for things like mental health, kind of investigating internet addiction. But as you were saying, Hannah, this is the whole thing about who gets to see job adverts,
mm-hmm.
who does get to see them. And that's the sort of thing that's at the moment is obscure as to how that happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it just kind of white men who are getting served up certain adverts? You know, that's the sort of thing that that you know that they're calling for. Yeah, so it's a quite an important report, something to be welcomed. I think I ran into your Jenny Tennyson, CEO of the ODI, the other evening. We were both at an economist event thing, and the one thing that she was a bit less sure of was the kind of emphasis on like individual responsibility, because as individuals, when we get those things saying, do you accept all the terms and conditions, you just go whatever.
You should not do that.
Well,
lots
of people do, and it's like, but if you put the onus onto individuals, then you know they don't really tend to take up that.
There's also the when you talk about personal ownership of data, there's the issue that a lot often when you're handling data, it's not always only about you. So
yeah,
for example, when you're sort of filling out a hospital next of kin card, you're sharing a lot of data about your relations or the kind of people closest to you, and so to have responsibility for you kind of assume that it's your data, but actually it might be data about a number of people, that particularly with social media, you know, with mutual connections, mutual friends, and you're tagging other people into things, it gets more of a grey area, so it makes it harder to have those conversations about personal ownership when it's hard to know where that line is drawn.
I think it's a good report, but it does seem like a very unequal struggle at the moment, at least, between governments on the one hand and Facebook, Amazon, Google and Apple on the other. We'll see who wins in the end. Hopefully we will, at least to some extent. I think that's probably all we've got time for this week, alas. Just remains for me to say, as usual, thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Claire.
Anytime.
And a massive thank you to Hannah for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been a real delight having you on the podcast. And thanks to our listeners for listening. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye.